because they're such good psychologist dogs as well. You're the most wonderful person when he comes to the door. Oh, I've missed you. Oh. It's really good feeling, isn't
it? Magical. So you were at the windmill for 7 months.
7 months.
And you were doing five shows.
I've never done
shows.
The arithmetic. 36 five. A week.
36
six shows a day, 6 days a week.
And you were still doing 12 minutes.
Yes. And the shows ran for a few weeks, and then the old man would say, I want a new act. In other words, if you want to keep working, I want a new act for the next show.
New material.
And I managed to keep going. And then towards the end, he used to do auditions in the morning, what's your act for another show? And he turned me down on the Monday and said, come in again on Wednesday. And I thought, oh my God. And I'm working meanwhile there. But I thought, I've got to think of a new act for Wednesday. He turned me down on Wednesday. And I thought, oh, that's it, it's over. And he said,
so wait, how did you get paid? Did you get paid after each week or each set?
You were paid by the week, but you know, if you did a
show.
So
if you're not working on Monday to Wednesday, you're not getting paid?
Sorry, what do you mean?
If he said, I want a new set, and he said, I'm
not. No, I was working at the time in a show.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I was working.
Oh, okay.
But in the morning, he'd say, come in and give me
new
stuff.
Okay.
And he turned me down twice, Monday and Wednesday. And I thought, well, that's it, it's over. And he said, well, come in on Friday. Three times that week, I did a new act. And I did an act for him on the Friday. And he said, dress rehearsal on Sunday. In other words, you're still working. And I thought, you really put me through the ringer this week. And I was still working. And then he suddenly called me into his office and said, well, that's it, out into the wicked world. And he gave me a letter to take with me. And it was over. And the letter said, to whom it may concern, he said, I still think he's funny. And I found out later that his PA, lovely woman called Anne Mittell, thought I was crap. And she was always saying to him, I found this out later, why are you still employing him? And the old man said, I like him. I've never forgotten, and I lost the letter when we moved house. But he was a great man. I had, touch wood, it's not bad now, I had real asthma in those days. And you used to have a big Bakelite inhaler. And you had a bottle of stuff called Ribavirin. And you had this... I hadn't thought about this for years. You poured it in, and there was a little sort of siphon, and there was a rubber bulb, and you would pump it. And I left it in North Finchley one day, and I was having a really bad asthma too. And the old man heard about it. Barry Cryer to Mr. Van Damme's office. So I go to his office, and he came out of his office, personally. He's quite a small man. Not asking anybody else to be pushing an oxygen cylinder with a mask. Come on, come
you.
On. Oh, I love that man. He's a great man. And they made a film called Mrs. Henderson Presents with Judy Dench, who can do no wrong. Well, she's a friend of mine, playing the woman who started the windmill. And Bob Hoskins played Vivian Van Damme. Now, it doesn't matter because people didn't know Vivian Van Damme. I mean, the last act you cast to play Vivian Van Damme was Bob Hoskins. And I thought, who cast Bob Hoskins? And then I saw who the executive producer of the film was, Bob Hoskins. And it's so boring. I worked at the windmill, and this was about the Second World War, long before I worked there. There wasn't a suggestion of that theatre in the film at all. There was no comic to be seen in the film. Will Young was in it.
Yes, I know. Will Young was in it. This is one of the things I wanted to ask you more about, because there are so many comics who refer to the windmill as the great days of the windmill. And yet, I can't, as a comic, I cannot think of anything worse than going on to an audience that doesn't
want
to see comedy. They want to go and see the girls taking their clothes off or to the pavement.
That's right. They came to see the strippers, who were very
decorous. So why was it so fantastic?
They couldn't move. It had this amazing era. Perversely, or conversely, Vivian Van Damme loved comedians. So he thought, I've got the basic bread and butter theatre because they come to see the strippers. Therefore, I can indulge and give comedians a break. And of course, the list of alumni, you know, there's Peter Sellers and
Tony Hancock.
Oh, Tony Hancock. No, the people who work there, amazing. And I think I said to you last time that it's 52 years ago, for heaven's sake, 1957. The man I met there, called Bruce Forsyth, and I never found out what happened to him. We've been friends ever since. Bruce was wonderful.
So was there a great sense of camaraderie?
Oh, yeah. Very much so.
Kept you all going.
Very much so. Camaraderie with, and I'm not saying girls patronising me. They were young, and people used to make, you know, remarks to me about, oh yeah, old Van Damme, you know, as if he was an old lecturer or something. No, he ran it very tight. You got the sack if you're in the wrong part of the building, because there were stone steps. I've been in years later and all the carpeted stairs and stone steps. And a sort of Y junction, turn left for the girls, turn right for the fellas. If you were found in the wrong part,
out,
you were sat. You could sit with a girl wearing a G-string sort of in the canteen upstairs in full view of everybody. That was fine. It was just an amazing era. Great camaraderie with them. There were two companies, A and B, and there were charts on the wall, what you're doing on any one day. An A company would work one day and B the next. But if you were an actor, comic, stand-up or whatever, you worked every day. But it was just so complicated, the system that ran there. It was fascinating.
Military operations.
Yeah. And we used to pop behind it. It was a tiny stage. It was a glass stage. I went R17 one day. They said it's happened to everybody. I walked on and just slid on the glass and crashed down. But we used to go behind the scenery and say smutty things to try and make our mates wobble when they were posing. It was very decorous. I used to say it was like a girls' school gone mad. And then Paul Raymond and the review bars opened, and that killed the windmill. Years later, the windmill was a Sky studio. Sky took it over. And the stalls were the studio, and the little circle was the sort of green room where you had a drink and then you went downstairs and did the show. And I was standing up there one day, I was going to be interviewed, and this voice behind me, this quite quiet voice, said, "Hello, Barry, I killed this place, didn't I?" It's Paul Raymond. Because the Lord Chamberlain had gone, you know, the strippers at the windmill never moved. After that, they did little else. They were writhing about and
doing just about everything with Paul. Bless him.
And of course, the windmill became outdated and quaint, and it was about to die.
But for you as a comic, I mean, apart from the camaraderie and whatever, you would go on many times a day
to a
dead audience.
Oh, yeah.
And what was so great about that?
We used to brag about laughs, you know. Bruce Forsyth, I used to watch a lot. He was superb. God, he was brilliant. Very visual, eccentric, moving, and jokes. But God, he was good. And I thought, this is what it's all about, this man. He's brilliant. And betraying no signs that he wasn't getting any laughs. I thought, oh God, I'm learning. He was superb, Bruce. And we became friends then. And we used to sit in the canteen. And he'd done a double act with his first wife, Penny. Then that broke up, sadly, personally and professionally. Then he became a single. And he said to me one day, "Oh, I've got as far as I've got to get. I'm going to pack it in." And I said, "What do you mean you're going to pack it in?" No, it's very nice and everything, but that's as far as I'm getting, isn't it?" I said, "What are you going to do then?" He said, "I've got an idea. I'm going to open a little tobacconist, a little shop." I said, "Well, don't want to." Anyway, that's the end of that. So anyway, I'd finished at the windmill, one thing led to another. 1958, I think it was in Kingsway. I'm walking along and there's Bruce. And I'd read about him. He was the new compere of Sunday Night at the Palladium. And that Sunday he was going to do his very first show live to millions of viewers. He'd just been to a press conference. And he went, "Barry!" And I said, "Bruce." I said, "Oh, how's it going?" I said, "I'm so thrilled. What's happened to you?" He said, "Oh, thank you very much. Oh, my God, Sunday, I don't know." And I said, said, what's happened to tobacconists? He said, postponed. Been postponed for 50 years.
And it's still been postponed as he rises and rises, yeah. So you, when you were chucked out, what happened? When you were let go with your left hand?
You're on the dole then. We used to sign on what we used to call a labour exchange in those days, the job centre. I used to sign on at Lisson Grove. And you made friends very quickly. That's the great thing about our business. You were young, you were out of work, you met other young people who were out of work, and you'd go to a pub and nurse half a beer for 4 hours. Or you'd go to a cafe and have a cup of tea. I've got friends to this day I met in that era. You were young and you were out of work, you were bonding. That was it. And it was great. My darling wife was signing on at Great Marlborough Street behind the Palladium. And we could compare.
And she was a dancer.
Yeah, no, well, she wanted. Ballet was her ambition. And then it wouldn't happen now. She got too tall. And it broke her heart. And it wasn't happening. So she trained as a singer. And she was in the West End. All the big. I say all. She was in Damn Yankees, Pajama Game, Carousel. She said, we didn't realise how lucky we were. Because while you were in one show, there'd be news of another show. And you'd audition for another show. She said, we went from show to show to show. She said, we never stopped working. We didn't realise then how lucky we were, she said. And we had mutual friends before we even met, because I finished up in a bed sit, Kildare Terrace, Bayswater, and she was in Westbourne Terrace.
Around the corner.
Yeah. And we never met in those days. But when we did meet, we compared notes. The number of people we both knew. Oh, I met her the very same day I met Ronnie Corbett. Rehearsals for Danny LaRue's show, not before Danny had his own club, Winston's Nightclub, Clifford Street, off Bond Street. And I met Terry, my wife, the very same day I met Ronnie Corbett. And I was tossed a coin and married her.
So being unemployed is quite a rich time.
It was, you would. Oh, God, I made a hilarious attempt to top myself at one point.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I got the. It was snowing. It was a Dickensian Christmas. I could have gone home to Leeds to my dear mother and sort of, you know, sold my heart out and everything. And looking back, I thought, I'm not going to do that. But it was so melodramatic. It's hilarious looking back. I actually had a gas fire in the room and I stuffed the window, the old sash window, with newspapers and turned the gas on and lay down and the gas ran out. And I hadn't had any money to put. And a mate of mine called Douglas Camfield, who became a very successful TV director, he comes knocking on the door. He was in a bed sit upstairs. And I said, oh my God. So I opened the window and try and hide all this newspaper and everything, and opened the door and Doug came in. You know, I can imagine his face. Never said anything. Smell of gas was just awful. And he said, you fancy a bit of spaghetti? And I went upstairs to his bed, sitting with spaghetti. Nothing was mentioned at the time. It was mentioned later. We were friends, you know. But, oh, it's so melodramatic. I thought, it's over. Oh. And there was a thing called National Assistance, where you had to sign on in Parade Street. And you were on the floor, you got nothing, and you had to give all your details. And I always remember some poor Irish guy getting over the counter, trying to get at the man behind the counter, trying to attack him. It was just heartbreak. And they said a representative will call. 13. Kildare Terrace, Bayswater. So when I was working at the Windmill, I sort of lashed out and bought myself a tiny little sort of Baker-like television set to cheer my bed sit up. So Doug, the aforementioned, we cleared my room out of anything that looked comfortable. So it was like a cell when this man came to call.
To make sure.
And
you
I get
really
the call. I get the call from landlady. Someone at the door for you. And I always remember it was raining. And this guy, hat and raincoat, his hat's dripping with rain, and he has a clipboard. And he said, Barry Cryer. And I said, yeah, you know, like, oh, God, he's coming to see the room, and what happens, everything. And he ticked me off and said, thank you very much. I said, what is that? No, he said, I just have to check you live where you say you do. And walked off. Oh, so melodramatic. I always remember that. And things got better, you know. But, oh, that was the rock bottom.
That was about 59, 58, 59.
That would be... No, that would be the interim, I think, very soon after the Windmill, I think, because things picked up in 58, because I auditioned for Espresso Bongo, the musical, and got it. Yeah, I think it would be Pot on the Windmill just in between, and I thought, well, it's over, you know, another false start, it's not happening.
And how did you know about the audition for Espresso Bongo? Was it like everybody knew what was going on and they talked to each other?
I think I've been traipsing around. You know, as I said, you met other people who were out of work and they'd tell you about auditions, and I think I went to agents' offices and something. I can't remember quite how it happened. And I was in North Finchley then. And I thought, Espresso Bongo. I was spelt wrong. Nobody could say espresso in those days. It had an X in it. Espresso. Espresso Bongo. I'll have to sing something at the audition. Bongo, bongo. So I sat in my bed sitter in North Finchley and wrote a song called Espresso Bongo about a kid who played the bongos. And then I thought, well, if you're going to do this at your audition, you'll need some bongos. I looked in my pocket, I don't know how much I had, but I went to, in Archer Street, Doc Hunt, D-O-C, Doc Hunt, music instrument shop, and he was very amused, and I said, can I hire some bongos? Hire bongos, what are you on about? I said, I'm doing an audition. Yeah? How long do you want them for? I said, well...
An hour, 2 hours.
And he was amused, and he charged me about £2 or £3 or something. I thought, he's broke me out now. So I went to the theatre, but I'd never had bongos before, so I sit waiting to go for my audition, you know, trying to play bongos. And I went on the stage next. And so, have you got any music? No, no. You've got a song? Yes. And I hammered these bongos that nearly fell from between my knees abysmally and sang this kid from the back street, kid with a new beat, playing the bongos. And there was a long silence. And then a man who became a friend of mine called Monty Norman, songwriter and everything, came on the stage and said, where'd you get that song? I said, well, I wrote it in my digs. He said, thank Christ. Thought we were going to get sued. And I got the job. I think it was a cheek that I sang a song called Espresso Bongo at my audition. And all thinking, where's he found that? The other audition story somebody reminded me of the other day, because they revived Oliver at the, you know, now, Rowan Atkinson. I auditioned for the very first production of Oliver for the part of the Undertaker's assistant, Noah Claypool. I always remember that. And I sang Someone to Watch Over Me, the old song. And Lionel Bart came on the stage and looked at me and said, you're mad. I didn't get the part. But then you see, as time goes on, Lionel Bart becomes a friend. You get to know these people. It's wonderful, you know. You get to know some of your idols and these famous people, because, you know, being a writer subsequently and everything, and you swap stories. Funny thing happened the way to the Forum. I was at Winston's nightclub by then, and we were doing Cleopatra, because it was the Burton Taylor film, and Danny played Cleopatra. But I had a toga and a breastplate and sort of, you know, laced up boots and everything, and a shield, as I remember. And I got an audition, funny thing happened the way to the Forum. So I nicked my costume from the nightclub, took it home that night, got up after about 3 hours sleep, went to the Strand Theatre. Oh, great, there's a little quick change dressing room next to stage. So I put this toga on and everything. And I thought, this show's sort of vaudeville music hall-y, although it's Roman. And I sang an old song from here, an old musical song. That was a cute little rhyme, tell us another one, wearing a toga. didn't get the part. Years later, I'm at Elsie Studios. Marty Feldman's doing a series, and great man Larry Gelbart, who created MASH.
Oh, okay.
Larry Gelbart and Bert Shevelov, great names. They'd written for anything up the way to Forum. So I now know this man, this great man, Larry Gelbart. We're chatting one day, and I said, I auditioned for Forum. And Larry said, oh, I wasn't at the London auditions. Bert saw the auditions. He said, he told me one morning an idiot came on wearing a toga.
And I went,
this is not radio. He said, you're kidding. I said, no.
So props and costumes feature quite largely in your failure and your success.
The what?
Props and costumes.
Well, I'm hopeless with props. I mean, the bongos fell from between the knees when we were doing the audition for it. It was just slapstick. I just can't. I'm inept. I can't handle props. If somebody says, well, you know, if you were doing a show and somebody says at this point singing a song and waving an umbrella, I can't do both. In Espresso Bongo, I was one of the dancers, which was hilarious. And dear Julie, I wonder where she is now, who was taller than me, big Julie, had to throw her between my knees. I mean, it was a source of much amusement to everybody else. And I think the choreographer was being sadistic, putting me and Julie together. I loved her, and she was big girl. But I think it's... yeah, probably the only time I've danced, really, professionally. Not surprisingly.
So what happened with Espresso Bongo then? You toured that for a while?
That was 10 months at the Savile Theatre, which is now a cinema, the other end of Shaftesbury Avenue. And then I got poorly. The eczema's running riot. And I had to pull out the show, actually. But I'd had 10 months of it. And I was in hospital a lot around that time.
With eczema?
Yeah.
Really?
People think, yeah, skin, what? And I've done stuff for the Eczema Society that people don't know. I was in my hometown, St. James Infirmary in Leeds, in the skin ward. A guy hung himself in the lavatory. He couldn't take any more. And people go, what? Oh, yeah. And I'm so lucky now, it's non-existent, my eczema, but I'll do anything for that area. Because people go, it's not life-threatening. You know, a doctor once said to me, oh, eczema patients, they're the best. You never lose a patient. But skin, it is a horror. The treatments now are the creams and everything and the drugs. And much better. It was old tar ointment in those days.
So you literally had to give up the job.
Oh yeah, you're right. I was the Invisible Man, bandaged from head to foot in Leeds at one point. I'm serious, and I had dark glasses on. I looked like those, you know, the Invisible Man. And I used to go to outpatients and send a car. I go in an ambulance, and one day. It's quite a nice day, and I remember walking out of Leeds Infirmary into City Square, into my hometown, wearing all that, banished from head to foot, dark glasses, just to see people's reaction. And I never saw anybody reacting. I turned around at one point and saw a little boy pointing, and his mother was going, dum, dum, dum. And I went into a tobacconist to buy some cigarettes. And this dear woman behind the counter looked at me, this apparition walked in, and she said, nice morning, isn't it? That's all she said. Bless her heart. I got the idea, I was reading about Jose Ferrer, who'd done the Cyrano de Bergerac film, and he said he walked around LA one morning with his nose on.
To see what it was like.
To see if anybody reacted. Yeah. And he said, he never saw anybody reacting.
Yeah.
Behind your back when you walk past, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought, God, it's weird the stuff you do when you... I thought, I'm going to walk round Leeds wearing all this and see if I see anybody noticing.
Yeah.
Weird.
So how long did that take to put you out of action for, then?
A few months, I think. Yeah, a few months. There was a whole troubled period. I was in... an inpatient 12 times in about 8 years, but I was managed to work sort of in between times, but it wasn't good.
So what makes you an inpatient then, that you literally your skin is so sore?
Yes, and your joints seize up. The elbows, the knees, the neck would become like concrete. You know, it would turn my head, you turn your whole, it's hard to visualise it though.
Yeah.
Your whole body turns when you turn your head. I could smack my neck and I couldn't feel it. It was just, as I say, concrete. It's quite amazing that anybody who's suffered from skin complaint to any serious degree will know what I'm talking about. It is a world of hell. It's not life-threatening, and you don't have operations, but, oh, it's a misery. I've always thought, particularly for women particularly, you know, getting really sensitive and worried, you know, it's awful. And if you, you know, you can cover it up with clothing. It's your face, neck and hands, basically. That's bottom line.
And also you can't move.
That's right.
Yeah.
And if your face, neck and hands are bad, you're just in misery. Mm. But I used to walk about that and I thought, I'm not going to sit in this bedsit going mad.
Mm. You know?
And then I met my wife, my darling, and I was in hospital once more as an inpatient after I married her. And never again. And I don't think it's a coincidence. No, there's a psychological route as well.
Right.
Very much so. I've talked to a lot of fellow sufferers. There's a lot of psychology in it. You're miserable, you're fed up, you're lonely, you're stressed, you're, you know, there's a lot of that. It's psychosomatic.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I can only speak from my own experience.
Mm-hmm.
Met my darling and went in hospital once and never again. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Not a coincidence, I don't think.
So after so you left Espresso Bongo, spent time in Leeds, and then what happened?
Then
you
I moved back came to back and another audition. Oh, there's a musical called The Quiz Kid. There was a whole new era of quizzes on television, Huey Green, God knows what. Excuse me. And an actor called Jimmy Thompson, his wife, wrote this comedy musical, Quiz Kid, where I played a quizmaster. And that toured, and then came to London. We were in Hammersmith, and the show rolled over into River and Tide, so that was another false start. No, it was a strange era. And then I met a lovely actress called Anna Quayle, and she was doing, we used to call them reviews in those days, you know, sounds a quaint word. Now, they always misspell it. Spell check doesn't cope with that. If any newspaper or any magazine mentions an old theatre review, they spell it R-E-V-I-E-W, and it's U-E.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's neither here nor there. And it was the Fortune Theatre in London before Beyond the Fringe, which was going to be a fortune. And Anna was in it. And I wrote a couple of things for her. And Danny LaRue came in one night. I've been dogged by good luck. And Dan said, who wrote that? And then Danny and the pianist MD of the show, Ted Dix, and I were invited for a drink with Mr. LaRue. And he invited us to write a show for his nightclub. Not his nightclub then, Winston's, as I mentioned. And then Ted had an argument about a bouncing check or something, quite rightly. But I finished up writing Danny LaRue's club shows for 13 years.
When and Danny LaRue was really important, famous, big transvestite,
people don't,
drag act,
well,
singing.
Paul O'Grady and several other guys around now say he was the one. He opened the door. Danny LaRue, he hated the expression drag act. And I say, Dan, what are you talking about? He was the first drag act to make it commercially, mainstream, be on television.
Yeah.
And Paul O'Grady always says this. He said, Dan was the man.
Mm.
And Danny was big. Mm. His club in Hanover Square was just Burton and Taylor.
Well, he's another
and
one
Beatles
that I remember reading about and thinking I had no idea. I think he was sort of, I had no idea how central to the entertainment industry he was.
My old friend Dick Vosborough and I, the American, my dear old friend, we wrote a show for Danny that ran for over 2 years at the Palace Theatre. That's how big he was.
Mm. on the shows, were they sort of a bit again like reviews, in that they had other people
sketches,
coming in,
songs, dancers,
dancing, yeah, and doing,
and Dan coming on as Marlene Dietrich and everything. It was great, lovely era. But he was big.
And were you doing any performing at that point?
No, I was just writing. It was just my, I've now gone into my writing mode. And the summer seasons at the seaside, Terry, my darling, used to be in them. They'd run 3 months. You can't imagine it now. They do Thursday, Friday, Saturday now. Don't even do the full week. Danny LaRue filled the Opera House Blackpool for 3 months. And that is a big
And that's
theater.
What, 2,000 seater or something? Yeah.
He was a massive star. Yeah. Then things change, time goes on. Years later, Danny is in Blackpool on the South Pier with his devoted Annie, his assistant, in a van. He used to have the Rolls Royce and all that. And there he is in a van.
And he spent
all the frocks, the dresses in the back.
Yeah.
Very generous man. People go, where's the money gone then? He was a wonderful host, lovely man. In Tunbridge Wells now with Annie.
Still?
Yeah. We keep saying we must do a benefit for him. And Tony Palmer. Not the male Tony Palmer, you know that. This is Tony Palmer, an old friend of ours who's in the nightclub shows with us. And she's cynical and accurate. She said, we say we're going to do a benefit for Danny LaRue. People go, really, Danny? Where's the money gone? You know, it's sad, isn't it?
I don't know. People live their lives differently, don't they?
He was so generous, he got taken for over £1 million. He opened an hotel near Stratford-on-Avon. This was his ambition. Oh, you know, I'll be the maitre of the hotel and all my friends will come and everything. And two Canadian con men moved in on him and ripped him off completely. They caught them, they went to jail, but he got ripped off completely. And Dan used, and man, you see, Dan loved it. He's had to give up now because he's not well. But Danny couldn't accept him. He said, oh my God. He said, I've got to keep working anyway. Those bastards. He said, I've got to keep earning.
Well, Lionel Bart was the same. He was terribly generous and huge parties and
Lionel
went bankrupt.
Threw it away.
Yeah.
Well, Lionel had money in bowls in his house and everything. You just take some money, help yourself. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff as well. But money. Serious money. Take money. I got bored. And Cameron McIntosh was eternal credit when he did the first revival of Oliver. Oh, 70s, was it?
Oh, I don't know.
Way back.
Yeah, yeah.
But Cameron, strictly speaking, didn't have to pay Lionel Bart a penny because Cameron had got the rights. And he paid Lionel a big royalty for the show. So this man wrote it. And that's to his credit. Lionel sold Oliver because he was desperate.
Didn't he sell it to Max Bygraves or something odd? Yeah.
And Max's agent, the exotically named Jock Jacobson. I love that name. And I thought, to the rich shall be given. You know, they got Oliver for probably a very good deal. And dear Lionel was just desperate. It had all gone. Mm. Oh, I can sell Oliver. That will save my life. He finished up in a little flat. And, oh, bless his heart.
I met him just through his nephew or something just before he died, about 2 years before he died. I think he seemed a very nice man.
Oh,
I only met
lovely.
Him briefly.
I used to rip him off. We were friends. I used to rip him off. I'll explain that. We used to do nightclub shows. We were a club show.
No, it's somebody else.
We used to do nightclub shows. And we could sort of get away with it in the club. I used to rip off Lionel's tunes and write different lyrics. And he did a musical called Blitz. And there's a song in that.
Quite a famous disaster?
It wasn't as big as a disaster as Twang. That was the big one.
Right.
Blitz had a bit of a run. But there was a song, Who's This Geezer Hitler? And then, yet again, at Danny LaRue's club, we did Cleopatra and blah, blah, blah. And I wrote a song, Who's This Geezer Caesar? You know, we just nicked all his tunes and did a miniature musical, but it was a rip-off of Blitz, but done as Cleopatra. And Lionel came in to see it one night. And I went over to have a drink with him, and he went... and I went... and we sat down and laughed, and he said, who's this geezer Caesar? That's better than my bloody size. Giza Caesar, he said, that's lovely.
Much better than Giza Hitler, yeah.
Oh, he's a darling.
So what would happen when you were doing Danny Roos? Would you, like, meet up in the morning, like, in the comics morning, so 11 o'clock, and sit down and say, right, what are we going to put in the show now?
Oh, hello, John.
What, rehearsing?
No, when you're writing for him.
Well, I was in the shows as well, so it was a strange life. I had a tin Olivetti typewriter and a zip-up case, and I'd written the basis of the nightclub show, but I would go into rehearsals and sit in the dressing room rattling out new stuff, writing the rest of the show while they're rehearsing it. And then somebody left or something. I finished up in the shows as well, so it was quite a life. And then I met a man called Roger Hancock, Tony's brother, and he said, you do Danny LaRue's shows, don't you? I said, yes. He said, you're in them, aren't you? I said, yes. And he was a writer's agent, obviously. He said, well, I don't want a writer who gets out of bed at midday with his head full of cotton wool. I always remember that. And he said, I'm interested, I'll take you on. No contract ever. I'm still with the same office. We shook hands. And he said, but it's up to you. So I went home to Terry and said, well, Roger Hancock says he's interested in me as a writer, but not if I'm performing as well and getting up at midday. She said, well, go with it. What do you think? So I honoured it. And Ronnie Corbett and I left the show at the same time. Ronnie, you know, fame was looming and Frost Report and stuff. And always remember, Danny said, oh, they'll be back. You know, television, this passing craze.
Yeah. So were you weaving, when you were writing for Danny's shows, were you weaving in contemporary stories and ideas? And
we weren't satirical, like, you know, that was the week that was or anything. It was broader than that. And no language, my God. We couldn't, anyway. But Danny was a prude. There was no fun or anything in a nightclub show. But you had to... I love filth when it's nicely worded. I created a character, or Danny and I did together, called Lady Cynthia Grope, who was a Tory lady with a, you know, twin set and pearls and everything. This is before Margaret Thatcher. We were spookily prophetic. And Danny would be interviewed, and I'd play the interviewer, or whoever played the interviewer. And he was full of lines like, what do you think of Michael Foot? A wild exaggeration, dear. Let's talk about Edward Heath. And people do, you know. It's full of that.
Yes, yes.
You know, nice wording.
So were you sort of writing almost every day for new stuff for the show?
No, once the show settled in. No, now and again you'd go in and something had been in the papers that day and we'd stick it in the show. Then, oh, I'll tell you a story. So the old name dropper, John Lennon. The Beatles came to the club, not together. I think they all four came separately at different times, but Lennon was in one night. This is all linking up. There was a heavy table in one night. John Lennon, Peter Sellers, Lionel Barton. I'm not making this up. And I was like the warm-up. We had the opening number, all went on, singing and dancing, and then I would tell some jokes and get the show going. And I'm telling a couple of jokes for the show, and this voice from the darkness said, this is satire, I suppose. John, very loud. And I said, no, it's nightclub filth. You must get out more. Oh! This got a laugh from the, even, you know, even the locals and everything. And I thought, oh boy, I've really done it now. So that was the end of that. Years later, he's now with Yoko. And we're in a green room at the old Wembley Studios. And for some reason, it was just me and John Lennon, and he had a black polar neck on and all that. And he looked at me and said, I know you, I know you. Where do I know you from? So I thought, well, the only possible. I said, Danny LaRue's Club. Oh, God. Danny LaRue's Club, yeah. And he said, a really strange thing. He said, was I a pig? And I said, what are you talking about? He said, oh, I was out of it. Didn't know what was going on. He said, yeah, it was you, wasn't it? In that show. I said, yeah. He said, oh, God, was I awful? Never forgot that. I said, you're an old one.
It's just another...
I can name drop. John Lennon said to me, was I a pig?
Yeah. Well, I'll have to go, Sean. You've got to go.
Oh, God, I'm enjoying this.
I know.
I hope you are.
I am. No, it's fantastic.